Okay. 09-1840, the United States versus Benjamin Garcia Garcia. Hi, Ms. Jackson.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case involves a Fourth Amendment violation because the trooper who stopped Benjamin Garcia Garcia operated under a mistake of law. He saw an air freshener hanging from his rearview mirror, so he cited him for having an obstructed windshield. And in the majority of states, it is against the law to have an obstructed windshield, but not in Illinois. In Illinois and two other states, only material obstructions of the windshield violate the law. That is why every Illinois court that has dealt with the statute at issue here has combed the record before it looking for evidence that the officer reasonably believed the object in question materially obstructed the driver's view before deciding to stop the driver.
Ms. Jackson, before we get there, what evidence were you trying to suppress?
The evidence Mr. Garcia-Garcia was trying to suppress was the van, his statements when he was stopped and spoke to the officer, the passengers in the van. There was cash in his possession. The passengers gave statements. And Trooper Weiss identified him as an illegal alien. That was the evidence. Now, there are three key points that I want to emphasize here. One is materiality.
How is that evidence relevant and probative on the charges facing your client?
He was facing two charges, one for illegal reentry after having been deported as an alien, and two, transporting illegal aliens. So the passengers were evidence of the transportation. The cash in his possession, the government was going to argue that this
was cash. So he's suppressing the other passengers?
They're evidence of his illegal transportation of aliens. The three points were materiality.
Did he plead guilty to both counts he was charged with, or just the illegal reentry?
He pled guilty to both, and when his motion to suppress was denied, he changed that to a conditional guilty plea. Materiality is a key.
Before you start, sure. poor Ms. Jackson, after reading the transcript of the suppression hearing, it seems to me that no one asked the trooper to clarify whether he thought the statute prohibited any obstruction versus only material obstructions. And so in the absence of any testimony or evidence, why should we draw an inference that an experienced trooper was mistaken about the law? The more natural reading of his testimony is that he was simply speaking in shorthand when he omitted the word materially.
Well, two reasons, Your Honor. That inference you are suggesting is basically the opposite inference, and there's no rule allowing and drawing an inference from facts that are not in the record. And the state courts that interpret this state statute that the state trooper here was purporting to enforce look for more in the record than we have here. They look for the officer testifying, saying the words material or materially, or giving some sort of indication that even if the person didn't say or write the words materially, the officer believed the obstruction was materially.
What about the fact that he cited the correct Illinois statute, mm-hmm. which does have the material in it, and the magistrate judge, who clearly understood the standard, reached the conclusion that there was probable cause to believe that a material obstruction existed, and he based that both on the trooper's credibility as well as the physical evidence, specifically the photograph showing the air freshener hanging down from the rear, from the windshield.
I'll start from the end. The photographs demonstrate nothing more than the fact that there was an obstruction in the windshield. So if we were in Arizona or Minnesota, where some other state where it's against the law to have an obstruction in the windshield or any object in the windshield, the photos would be enough. They would show a violation of the law. But in Illinois, you need to have not only something in the windshield, but you need to have an officer who thinks that that's materially obstructing your view. The cases go both ways. Sometimes an object in your windshield can materially obstruct your view, and sometimes the officer thinks it doesn't.
But so, how do you get past Judge St. Eve's point, which is that the warning ticket read 12503C, obstructed windshield? The natural reading of the testimony and the ticket is that he stopped the car because the air freshener violated that statute. The trooper presumably knows the law he cited on the ticket, so didn't he have to know that the obstruction had to be material?
That's actually, I would submit, not a natural reading of the testimony. And just a preliminary matter, there's no presumably no here, not under the probable cause standard and not under this court's mistake of law jurisprudence. It's the government's burden to justify, legally justify, all of its searches and seizures.
Well, what in the record supports an inference to the contrary?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I'm sorry. What in the record would support an inference to the contrary?
To the contrary, meaning?
That the trooper, when he writes down the precise statute, knows the law.
I would submit that the record only demonstrates that the record possibly demonstrates that the trooper thinks the statute is just about any obstruction.
Because he actually says material.
But none of his testimony and none of the other facts that the government presented at the suppression hearing demonstrate an understanding beyond mere obstruction. Sure, that's what the statute says. And the government did not do that. It was the government's burden to ask.
Well, either one of you could have asked that question.
The defense did put on evidence that the air freshener was not materially obstructing Mr. Garcia-Garcia's view. Mr. Garcia-Garcia testified twice that that air freshener was not materially obstructing my view.
But that's not the issue, whether or not it was actually, whether or not
correct.
He could be convicted of
yeah.
it is
correct.
Not the issue. The issue is whether or not a reasonable officer in those circumstances would believe there's probable cause that it did. And if you look at the photos that show the air freshener hanging down, why wouldn't that be enough along with the officer's testimony?
That is not enough because if you look at all of the Illinois appellate court opinions construing this statute, they are looking for a specific facts in the record showing the officer's reasonable belief that the air freshener was material, not just that the officer saw an air freshener,
given
but that he believed it.
Given the Seventh Circuit's cases, Ms. Jackson, including the Smith case, what weight should we give and what impact or precedential value do those Illinois cases have?
Those Illinois cases are state cases construing the state statute at issue here that a state trooper was enforcing. And Smith's usefulness is very limited here, and I'll tell you why. One, Smith only holds that an air freshener can create the grounds reasonable suspicion that 12503C has been violated. It doesn't hold that an air freshener per se violates the statute. And two, Smith does not discuss any evidence of materiality in the record. So there's nothing in Smith showing you how the district court got to its conclusion and how this court affirmed that conclusion. And so Smith is operating under the same error that we are raising now here on appeal.
Well, No. In Smith, the defendant didn't allege that the officers were acting without authority to make the stop. They argued instead that the reason for the stop was a pretext, and that argument wouldn't get them anywhere now that we have Wren in
right,
the
Supreme Court. And that's not the argument that Mr. Garcia-Garcia is making. But the problem with Smith, as I was explaining, is that there is no evidence of there's no discussion of materiality, and that is a key element in the statute. This statute does not function without that word material in it, or else we'd be in another state.
So every time a trooper stops you for, you know, an air freshener, he has to say, I am stopping you because there is a material obstruction.
That's one of many things that could have happened here. You can have the officer at the stop saying that and explaining it. You can have the officer on the stand explaining it. You can have the government presenting some other evidence to suggest that even if the officer is not saying it. And all of those things are present in these Illinois state cases. It's not present here.
But again, what precedential value do those cases have for the Seventh Circuit?
This court should be looking to how the state courts are construing their own statute. This is a state statute that this state trooper was enforcing, and Smith is limited in that regard.
You know, you're way into your rebuttal, so I'm going to
thank you.
Give you time for rebuttal. And if Ms. Mullins would.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Linda Mullen. I represent the United States. We have a couple of very brief points to make today. The court has actually made a lot of the points that I intended on making. And our first bottom line point is that this just simply isn't a mistake of law case. Our second bottom line point is that even if, for the sake of argument, we were to agree that the officer did not have a full understanding of all the nuances of this statute, on this record in this case, it simply wouldn't matter. Because we don't look to see just what the officer says. As the court has already pointed out through questioning, we're going to look at the entire record. There were photographs submitted in this case. The air freshener itself was submitted. The warning ticket that identified the statute was submitted. The magistrate and then the district court reviewed the testimony of the officer and found he is credible. We believe that he saw what he said he saw. They looked at the air freshener itself and said it was bright pink with white stripes, and concluded that looking at all of that evidence, a reasonable officer in Officer Weiss's position would have believed that he had probable cause to pull this car over for the obstructed windshield. There's nothing, going back to the first point about whether or not this is a mistake of law case, as the court has pointed out, there's nothing on this record to suggest that the police officer didn't understand that nuance of the statute. I also want to make the point that our processing of
why did he talk on and on in his testimony about the fellow being stiff behind the wheel, driving in the left-hand lane, and 2 miles under the speed limit? What was the relevance of all this? The reason he was going to stop this guy was because of the obstruction of the windshield.
I think it probably wasn't relevant, Your Honor, but I think he was asked what drew your attention to this vehicle, and
Or was he looking for somebody who was carrying drugs or illegal immigrants?
He might have been, and he said, you know, I think honestly answered the question, what drew your attention to this particular vehicle? And he said it was suspicious the way the vehicle was driving below the speed limit. As the vehicle approached, the driver looked very nervous and rigid and wouldn't look at me. That's, you know, contrary to my experience with typical drivers.
The driver had his eyes on the road and was following every single legal...
Right, certainly one of those things, we encounter this all the time, right, where somebody is doing the officer says he has reasonable suspicion because the person looked straight ahead, or the officer has reasonable suspicion because the person looked at them and looked nervous or was sweating or wasn't sweating, and those things, you know, ultimately are irrelevant. So we go back to, did this officer have probable cause? And those other things end up being irrelevant in the analysis. But I was sort of trying to process through, you know, why are we sort of ships passing in the night on this mistake of law issue? And that seems to be the crux of the party's disagreement. And I thought about it like this. Let's say that the speed limit is 55 miles per hour.
But the officer thinks it's 40.
Exactly where I was going. And the defendant is traveling, you know, 50 miles per hour. And the officer pulls over in good faith, thinking that the defendant is breaking the law. Well, we have no probable cause there, and that's a case that's going to get thrown out if that's all the officer has. But let's say the opposite is the case. Let's say that the speed limit is 45 miles per hour, and the trooper thinks that it's 65 miles per hour, and the defendant is traveling 55 miles per hour, and is clocked at 55 miles per hour, but the trooper thinks, well, that's not violating the law, but I think those tinted windows do violate the law, and pulls the defendant over for tinted windows. Now, let's further assume that tinted windows aren't a violation in that particular jurisdiction. And we go into the suppression hearing, and the officer testifies, well, I clocked him at 55. I pulled him over for the tinted windows. And it's explained that, well, no, that is speeding. You're wrong on both fronts. That's a violation of the speeding laws, not a violation of the tinted window laws. We don't throw that case out. I mean, that case is supported by probable cause, even though the officer was doubly wrong. And that's why here it's our position that ultimately it doesn't matter whether he understood the nuances of materiality. If there was a flat-screen TV hanging from the rearview mirror and the officer came in and said, you know, upon closer inspection, I didn't think that that materially obstructed the windshield, That officer would be laughed out of court. I mean, obviously, we're looking at what a reasonable officer would think about what he or she was presented with. And here the magistrate and district court had all of that additional evidence by which they could assess the reasonableness of pulling over the defendant for this. And,
traveling 63 miles an hour past the officer, he was able to make an estimation of 4-inch air freshener.
And that's a credibility determination, Your Honor, that was actually what the party spent most of the time looking at in district court. That was the primary focus.
The district court got involved in all these other things, too. Why?
I can't answer that. I don't know whether...
Frankly, the district court's opinion has an aura of rubber stampism to it.
The district court opinion,
yes,
of the magistrate's opinion?
Rubber stampism.
That may be the case. It looked to me in reading the opinion that the district court very carefully at least went through the transcript.
It's hard after when I was reading all this material. It's hard to see when an officer could not stop somebody on I-55. For the last 20 years, we've been dealing with I-55 cases around here, and it's been an incremental march of more and more uncircumscribed authority to the police officer. What's left?
Not to drive on I-55.
Well, and I think maybe part of that comes with the shift in jurisprudence as well. I mean, when we have cases like Wren that say we're not going to look to...
It will be that we have also been responsible for an incremental tolerance of this. I'm wondering if it's time to draw the line when you see a district court opinion like this one.
Well, I think that, we have to step back even from the district court to the magistrate who's looking at the evidence and crediting the police officer. I mean, that's where we start with these credibility determinations about did you see what you really claim to have seen and could you have seen it with a vehicle traveling this speed? And, I wasn't there. I didn't hear the evidence and I didn't see the witnesses, but it was certainly the magistrate made a point of saying, I find this officer to be highly credible, went into what his eyesight was. And I think, in fact, it was the magistrate who asked that question, not the prosecutor. What was the color of this? How far was it hanging down? So there was a lot of, I think, challenging or questioning of the officer on that very point. That was the focus of the testimony, and ultimately the magistrate determined that the officer was credible and had seen what he said he saw. Now, the district court is working off the same record and, perhaps gave some deference to that. I don't know.
Now suspicious in the state of Illinois to travel 2 miles under the speed limit.
Well, I don't...
Are you going to afford your professional courtesy going home? really. I mean, that's what it amounts to, isn't it? The guy's driving a little bit below the flow of traffic. He's staying 2 miles within the speed limit. That's suspicious. Let's take a closer look. Pull him over.
Well, and that's an issue that this court has...
Unbridled discretion.
This court has pointed out that problem, I think, in all kinds of our cases that depend upon reasonable suspicion, has rightly called officers on the carpet for, not everything that just because you say something is suspicious doesn't mean that it's objectively suspicious, even if you have that training and experience. So I think those are definitely issues to look at. I've seen many cases out of this court where officers have been criticized or the reasoning has been criticized. Just because there's a furtive movement in the car doesn't mean that it's suspicious. Somebody moves their shoulders and you're calling it suspicious.
Well,
and
the guy didn't move his shoulders and he's suspicious.
That's right. Or you're sitting stiff and you're suspicious. And so all of those things, I think, need to be looked at very carefully. But again, this case didn't come down to those movements. If those were the only reasons that the police officer pulled over the defendant, we wouldn't be standing here. I mean, that's obviously doesn't amount to reasonable suspicion or probable cause of anything. And that's why the issue of the probable cause of the air freshener becomes critical. I'm going to make one quick final point, and that is, Judge Rovner, you asked of a young attorney earlier today, why are we here? And I think I have a little bit of that same feeling, because as we pointed out, probably not thoroughly enough at the end of our brief, it's unclear to us where we get even if this evidence were all suppressed. I mean, with the respect to the illegal reentry, we only need the identification of the defendant. You can't suppress that. Even if you could, let's assume that it all gets thrown out. The defendant's walking out of the courtroom. All the police officers have to do is walk up and say, show us some ID. I mean, they know who this person is, and they know he's here illegally. I don't know that you can suppress bodies or that you would have a privacy interest in the bodies of the people traveling in your car, and so, and certainly not in the statements of those people, of the illegal aliens that the defendant was transporting. So,
could you make a case that under the inevitable discovery doctrine?
I thought about that actually after receiving the reply brief and sort of working through, and I guess I processed it a little bit more, and maybe it's inevitable discovery, that there was a separate probable cause. When the officer comes up, he pulls him over for the air freshener, but when he comes up and asks for ID, it would be sort of like discerning that the defendant had a warrant out, something like that. We don't let the person go at that point. I mean, once the officer got the ID and that was all that was required to establish probable cause for a separate offense, we have a, and I don't know whether that's the attenuation doctrine or inevitable discovery, but I think that's yet another reason why the opinion of the district court should be upheld. I see that I'm out of time. So thank you.
Your Honor, quickly, there's no inevitable discovery argument to be made here because the officer never would have had a chance to ask for the ID if he hadn't pulled him over for this stop, which was not supported by probable cause. There is an absolute harm to having a conviction on your record that is there improperly. And Mr. Garcia-Garcia
was... what your...
That is there improperly.
That is there improperly.
Exactly.
Thank
so
you.
He would suffer that harm if this decision were allowed to stand. And I want to note that this court has expressly rejected one of the contentions that the government just made. And that is, ultimately, the government said, it doesn't matter that he doesn't understand the nuances of materiality. This court has expressly rejected that. This court has said we need officers to properly understand the law, or else there's no incentive. If we don't enforce mistakes of law, there's no incentive for police officers to properly understand the law they are to enforce and to obey. And otherwise, there'd be no deterrence for officers in violating people's Fourth Amendment rights, because they can always say, oops, I mistakenly thought I was enforcing a law that was on the books. And so we get to a universe we don't want to be in. So the Constitution and this court and the Supreme Court have given officers leeway in searches and seizures, leeway to make those searches and seizures, but they need to have a legal justification that's grounded in some sort of objectively reasonable grounds here. We submit that the entire record is insufficient, especially under these state court decisions I do urge the court to look at. And I urge the court to go through the record carefully and see all the inferential leaps that were made by, first, the magistrate judge, and I agree, Judge Ripple, rubber-stamped by the district court here, and determine that, yes, the motion to suppress should have been granted. Thank you.
Now, you were court-appointed, weren't you? Well, you certainly have the sincere thanks of the court for the very fine job that you've done for your client. And thank you as well for the fine job you did for your client, which is all of us. Okay, thank you. Case will be taken under advisement.